This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
I'd like to start by acknowledging that we're meeting tonight on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and pay my deepest respect to elders past, present and emerging. I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting on lands for which sovereignty was never ceded and a treaty never signed. And we're really excited tonight to be talking about self-determination and the need for a First Nations voice to Parliament and the importance that the Uluru Statement of the Heart is going to be playing in that process in terms of how we move forward as a country and a democracy. So for tonight's discussion, I am so excited to be joined on the stage tonight by Gillian Triggs, Teela Reid and Kristen Hilton. These are three household names that probably don't need an introduction, but I'm going to give you an introduction anyway. You can applaud if you want, you know. Why not? So on the end, in the immaculate blue outfit for this evening, as always, we have Gillian Triggs, the former president of the Australian Human Rights Commission. And Gillian is also the chair of Justice Connect. And for many years, Gillian has been an outspoken advocate of the need for an Australian Charter of Human Rights. And we're very lucky to have her to join us here tonight. Can we please welcome Gillian? We're also joined by Teela Reid. Teela is a proud Wurundjeri and Wailwan woman and a full-time criminal defence lawyer. She was invited to be a working group leader on the race power in the Sydney Constitutional Dialogues that resulted in the Uluru Statement of the Heart. And you may remember her from her appearance on Q&A where she spoke to the former Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, about the importance of this piece of history in Australian history as a whole. Can we please welcome Teela? And last but by no means least, we're joined by Kristen Hilton. Kristen is Victoria's Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commissioner, and she's been very busy lately working on investigations into sexism and sexual harassment in Victoria Police, and most recently releasing a report looking at discrimination against people on the basis of their mental health in the travel insurance industry. The Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission will be hosting a faith leader roundtable on religion and discrimination. Can we please welcome Kristen? And over the course of tonight's session here, you'll be seeing Linda and Kim up the front, who will be our Auslan interpreters for this evening. Thank you to Linda and Kim. Okay, so tonight we're here to talk about an Australian Charter of Human Rights. We'll have about 45 minutes where I have the responsibility of trying to engage you and hold your attention, and then I'll be throwing it over to you. So if you have a burning question, I do ask that you please write it down or put it on your phone, and I'll give you the opportunity to ask it at the end of tonight's wonderful meeting conversation tonight at the Wheeler Centre. So, Australia is the only democracy in the world without a Charter of Human Rights. Or equivalent legal protections. But what does this mean in practice? And when we were talking about having this event here tonight, we started thinking about, why does this matter? When we talk about human rights, what are we actually talking about? What is this concept of human rights? And why is it something that hundreds of you have come out tonight to hear about? And I thought it's a bit of a broad topic, but when it comes down to it, in one way or another, all three of you have dedicated your life to human rights. Why is human rights something that needs to be spoken about more? And what should we be thinking about when we think about that term, human rights? Gillian, I'll start with you.
Thank you. Well, I think that at base, human rights is not a particularly difficult subject. It's about the basic dignity and respect for every human being. Why it matters so much for us in Australia is that we have become quite isolationist, exceptionalist in failing to have the legal tools in place to allow the courts to provide a check and balance against the growing and unprecedented power of government. And we've seen that recently, and I'm sure we'll come back to that later this evening. But my key point is that if we had a legislated Charter of Rights that will protect children, protect juveniles in the criminal justice system, protect asylum seekers and refugees, protect older people against elder abuse, ensure that we all get medical care that we need. If we had provisions that protected those rights, then the courts would have the tools to stand up against governments that are failing to respect those rights in far too many cases. So perhaps that will get us started at least.
Excellent. And Teela, did you have anything to add?
I think it just comes down to, all of us have the same human rights. I think the dilemma in Australia is there's just this lack of accountability in being able to enforce those rights. And I do support a legislative charter of rights, but I also support the entrenchment of a First Nations voice to Parliament in the Constitution for many reasons, and you can ask me more questions about that later. But I just think that it comes back to the point, people are now having more discussion about this because we can no longer rely on the politicians to respect our rights. So it comes back to the people being able to enforce them and be accountable. And in order to get that legislative charter, the people must have a say and push for that themselves. So it's just the lack of accountability for me, from my perspective, which is why we need one.
But I might follow up on just something that you said. You've talked about the lack of accountability. You've talked about the fact that historically Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have really been have been targeted by so many laws and policies that have been discriminatory and haven't had those tools to hold them to account. Do you think that a charter is going to be an effective solution?
Yeah, I think it will be effective, but it's not the only solution to our dilemma with human rights in Australia. I think it's a fundamental start. When you think about the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander experience in Australia, and also the law as it stands, we have this principle of legality, which means, we have the rights unless Parliament say with explicit terms that they abrogate our rights. And often, as an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, they're more than willing to abrogate our rights. So that was the beauty and the power and the force behind the Uluru Statement, going, we want to assert our rights. We seek the right to self-determination. But at the same time, it truly respected that every Australian deserves fundamental human rights. So, yeah, it's about an accountability mechanism for First Nations, because we can no longer rely on the High Court, unfortunately. That was one of the things. So I was the working group leader on the race power, and we know through High Court decisions that power has been interpreted to work to the benefit and the detriment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. So one of the most powerful things that came out of that was that people were saying, we can't rely on litigation anymore. We need a more proactive role in the democratic process. And we invite Australia to hear our voice.
And I think something that the movement has done so well has been travelling across the country and making sure that your voice is heard. And, it's been fantastic. We're just so lucky to have you here tonight to speak to us as well. And I think something that you've spoken about, not many people know that the Australian Constitution has a race power that allows the Australian government to effectively make decisions that target a group of people on the basis of their race. And once they learn this, it is a game changer for many people. I didn't know that this existed. How could I not know that this existed under law? And the same could be said about a charter. Many people don't know that Australia doesn't have a Charter of Human Rights. Lots of people assume that we do. And in Victoria, we're one of only two jurisdictions in Australia that has a Victorian Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities. And as your experience, as the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commissioner, what did the charter change when it came to Victorian law? What have been the positive elements of having a charter here? And what are some learnings from the Victorian experience that we should learn from in the Australian context?
So I think, and just going back to the premise of why human rights matter as well, and picking up on both Gillian and Teela's points, we see every day at the Commission people who have felt excluded or disconnected or have been discriminated against on the basis of some attribute. And I think human rights, you know, you can talk about human rights in a philosophical, legal or moral sense. As a lawyer, I tend towards the legal, but they all overlap. And when you start to talk about rights, you start to engage the concept of obligations and accountability. And that's why I think they are such a powerful tool, because the morality of human rights and the idea that everyone is born free and equal and should be treated with respect, dignity, freedom and equality, we can't... And history has shown this, that we can't depend on governments or individuals to self-regulate in that way. So this is about a powerful system of checks and balances. The stories that we hear are that human rights matter. If you are a parent who has a child that has a disability and is being discriminated or treating very poorly at school, they matter if you're someone who's putting a parent into aged care and you're concerned about the treatment that person is going to receive. They matter if you're the one in three women who will be sexually harassed at work during your lifetime. They matter if you're a gay man who wants to teach at a religious school. So these are all everyday examples of where an all-encompassing rights framework would assist not just in the development of policy, but also where rights are breached, that there is a remedy. So to talk about the Victorian experience, we've had a charter here for over a decade, and there was a really strong movement and very strong community and government leadership to bring a charter into Victoria all those years ago. And the model that we have here in Victoria is that there are a number of rights, and they're mostly what we call civil and political rights, that are encompassed under the Charter. Some of the, you know, we've had it for some time now, we can sort of see what the strengths and opportunities, I think, are. Some of the strengths have definitely been that there's a greater awareness of rights and obligations, I think particularly amongst the Victorian Public Service. And we've seen the way an engagement in rights and what they mean has helped to shape policy, has helped to shape legislation, both at a government level and also at a local council level even. And then we've seen the charter be used, for example, in court cases where it has had a great influence in terms of judges taking into account whether or not human rights have been breached in a particular instance. I think one of the challenges that we still have with the Victorian Charter is that it doesn't have a dispute resolution clause. So unlike, for example, our Equal Opportunity Act, you can't make a complaint directly under the Charter that your rights have been breached. It also doesn't have a direct cause of action. That means that you have to piggyback onto some other legal proceedings that you may have going to be able to discuss or to try and advocate for your charter right. It's pretty silent on remedies, and it also doesn't include economic, social and cultural rights. When I talk about economic, social and cultural rights, I'm talking about things like the right to education, the right to health, the right to housing. And if you ask most Victorians, most Australians probably, what they care about on a day-to-day basis, it's going to be those rights. Queensland, which is about to have their Human Rights Act, is it been passed? I think it's been passed. Yes, it's been passed. Comes into effect, I think, 2020. Mm-hmm. They have included in their act the right to health and the right to education. So Victoria looked very progressive 10 years ago. I think we've got some catch-up to do now. The other thing that the Charter doesn't have is a clear right to self-determination. So all of those things, so the Charter has absolutely made a difference in terms of policy, legislation, the way in which we talk about rights in this state, much more at a preventative stage than perhaps at a sort of curative stage because of the issues with breaches and remedies. But I think there's also great potential now as we're seeing developments in other jurisdictions for Victoria to try and hold on to that mantle of being a very progressive state and to look at the ways in which the Charter can be strengthened.
And I think I think that's something that definitely in the debates that we're having about a national charter we can hopefully learn from. I realised that I never actually introduced myself. I just sat down and started talking. My name's Lee Carney. I'm a senior lawyer at the Human Rights Law Centre. And when you were speaking, I was thinking about a case that the Human Rights Law Centre ran a couple of years ago. This is the case about children being transferred from a youth detention facility into the Barwon Maximum Security Adult Prison. And it took litigation. It took us running court cases, which said, actually, it is children need to be in a facility where they can access education and where they have appropriate facilities and where they're not subjected to cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment. And the court agreed. But that was the only mechanism that we had in Victoria to try and stop this action, which was wrong, even though it was popular. And I think that's something that when we think about a Charter of Human Rights and that baseline that it draws in the sand is something that we really have to think about the fact that even though the majority of people might think that something should be done, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right thing that should be done. And hopefully that's where a charter can draw that line and say, actually, everyone has human rights that need protected.
And I think, sorry, just to jump in, Lee, because we were also involved in that case, our role was in trying to articulate to the court how to balance certain rights. So this was a group of kids that were at the Parkville Detention Centre and had been transferred to a maximum security prison. And one of the things that the courts did when they were looking at the rights of the children and the government's decision and the government's policy around the transfer was to say, were there other alternatives that could have been implemented which were less restrictive on the children's rights? And it was a very important decision for that reason, because it really looked at, you know, how various rights rub up against each other in a particularly controversial situation, because there was no doubt that there'd been damage done to Parkville, there were concerns from youth justice workers in Parkville, but were there alternatives to placing children in a maximum security prison? And the court ruling was really instrumental in saying when government makes these sorts of decisions that will directly affect a young person's right, then they need to consider whether there is a less restrictive approach to whatever action it is that they deem to take.
Difference between something like Victoria having a charter and then going through processes, something like the Dondale, you know, that Royal Commission, where a bunch of Aboriginal children get effectively dragged through this traumatic process, where there's virtually 100% of the Northern Territory prison population is Aboriginal children up there. And, you know, a charter could have a very persuasive effect on implementing the recommendations that come out of something like a Royal Commission. I think Australians are really tired at the moment of going through various Royal Commissions, costing the taxpayer a lot of money. And what we see is a very fancy report without any implementation. So just different context, but the persuasiveness of something like a human rights charter where there is this, you know, right to liberty, really there as a tool to enforce.
Well, I completely agree. And I the point of contrast, you make one, which is the Dondale Detention Centre for the Northern Territory. There's no charter. So the courts couldn't intervene in those processes to ensure that the basic rights of those juveniles. Yeah. But a point of contrast that's exactly on point is the case of juveniles in adult facilities, because at the Australian Human Rights Commission at the federal level, we intervened with the permission of the court in Western Australia on an almost identical case. And there, although we had quite a sympathetic Chief Justice, he pretty much said, we haven't got a charter. The legislation is clear. The government's made a decision that these juveniles will be held in an adult maximum facility. There's nothing we can do about it. So that if you want to think about why we need a charter, that was a very good illustration. But I think, of course, we have to realise that at the moment we're talking about state and territory laws. What we really need is something all-embracing at the federal level that can help to create the environment that Kristen has described. In other words, going to the courts and litigation is relatively rare. Mm. That's not really going to solve the problems in many cases, most cases. But what's happened in Victoria is that a culture of human rights has grown up so that people in Victoria, and public servants, as Kristen has said, will be very alert to the fact that there's this quite complex and detailed description of fundamental rights. Apart from the ACT, and until Queensland one comes into operation, we've got nothing else in Australia. And it's very noticeable to me when I've been speaking across Australia, both in my former job and in the last couple of years, a massive difference between the way Victorians think about this issue and the way the rest of Australia thinks about it. And I think that's why I've become so committed in my own view that we need that legal tool. And I wonder if I could just pick up on another point that Taylor's raised, and that is it's a great, with great sadness for me, a disappointment as a lawyer for more than 50 years, that I agree with her comment that we can no longer rely on the High Court of Australia. The High Court of Australia got rid of terra nullius and accepted the right of Aboriginal Australians as the first peoples and their right to property and to land. That was a much more progressive and enlightened court that was willing to get rid of a legal fiction. But in recent years, we've had a much more conservative court that is much more inclined to say, if Parliament has passed that law and the law is clear and unambiguous, we won't overturn the view of a representative parliament. And if you ask an ordinary person on the street, does that make sense? They'll say, of course it does. We've elected the representatives. And so what they say really should be the final word. But the reality of a representative system of democracy is that we need the checks and balances. And at the moment, we've got an almost unprecedented situation in Australia outside wartime where ministers and ministerial discretions and the legislation that is passed by compliant parliaments, particularly over the last 15 years, has left us without the checks and balances that a healthy democracy really needs. And I'm sorry if that's a bit abstract, but that's really the context within which Australia is so unusual, because our friends across the Tasman, the New Zealanders, have had a Charter of Rights for 22 years, the Canadians, the British, most of Europe, North America, they speak the language of human rights. But in the main, in Australia, we really don't. And that is a big impediment to dealing with these detailed questions, whether it's asylum seekers, Indigenous youths in Don Dale, and children in adult facilities.
And I think... Sorry, Lee.
OK, one more.
Can I jump
it's
in
OK. For a
second? I think, you know, we are a poorer country for it. And even here in Victoria, where we've had the Charter for over a decade, governments are still reluctant often to use the language of rights. So they still talk about a fairer Victoria or having a fair go. And the idea, an all-encompassing rights framework, would also, I think, assist in bringing together some of the differences across our states and territories in a way that, you know, I was in South Africa years ago and looked at the way in which they had embedded their constitutional Bill of Rights. I'm going to Canada next week, and I know that in Canada they have the Canadian Human Rights Act. You can get it at service stations. It's in every motel room. It's part of their national psyche. And I think particularly at a time where we're seeing the sorts of quite unprecedented actions that this government is taking, but also globally, that to have a unifying framework that all Australians could see themselves in, that had the accountability mechanisms entrusted in it as well, would be incredibly powerful.
Well, let's talk about some of the actions of the current government. Obviously, we had a federal election recently, and we have the Morrison government, and then mere weeks after being re-elected, we've seen a series of raids on journalists, targeting journalists and whistleblowers. We've seen the use of these really unprecedented powers, which wind back democratic freedoms and target press freedoms in a way that I think most Australians haven't realised they could be used. And what do these, you know, Australian federal police raids on journalists, what do they say about the state of our democracy? What do they say about what the current Australian government anyway is willing to do when it comes to executive overreach and human rights?
Well, that is what has happened. And if we can draw an historical line in the sand, it was from 2001, the Children Overboard misstatement, proven to be false, totally false, the Tampa crisis, and 9/11, And from that year, we've seen the conflation of asylum seekers, of those of the Islamic faith, and terrorism. And that gives us a bit of an historical perspective. But what has happened since then has been an extraordinary avalanche of counter-terrorism and counter-espionage laws, including the so-called foreign interference laws, which gives you a flavour of this. We have had 75 separate pieces of legislation since 2001. We're in a state of what overseas academics describe as hyper-legislation in Australia. We've got more laws than the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom. And they come in, if you notice, well, you probably won't, but in 2 weeks before Christmas, those last sitting days of Parliament, that is when you find these laws start slipping through. The rest of us are enjoying pre-Christmas, and yet another law has gone through. The espionage foreign interference laws went through, but you can track that back. What has happened is we've given the new Ministry of Home Affairs, and to be particular, Mr. Dutton, powers that ministers have never had before. They're discretionary powers, and they're ones that are not amenable to judicial determination for the most part, without getting more legally technical. And I'm afraid we start to see it when we see these kinds of raids. But that is when the public outrage begins. And that's, I see, as a healthy thing. Just as Tila's mentioned, Dondale Detention Centre, the CCTV footage and the images of Dylan in a steel restraint with a hood over his head, that woke the Australians up to say, in our name, this cannot be possible. And we got a Royal Commission, not with the outcomes necessarily that we wanted, but to come back to the point, we're in a period now where the governments believe that it can get away with these attacks on our democratic freedoms. It's true, of course, that journalists are in probably the best position to protect their own interests, and they do. They're very, very loud, and journalists have all sorts of exceptions in relation to invasions of privacy and to the access and reporting of information. But what concerns me really even more than the media is that these are powers that are used against ordinary Australians who do not have access to the immense power of the media to complain. And we've seen in the last week or so, we've seen News Corporation and Fairfax and all the journalists all making the same point. It's very rare to see them coming together. But you can see the power of journalism in protecting their rights. But we're not very good at protecting our own when it comes to the treatment of our children, the treatment of our first peoples, and the elderly, as stories slowly emerging. But I think that's the environment that has slowly, slowly been created. And it's only when we see the sort of cataclysmic event, like raids on News Corporation, the Dylan Villa, the Dondale Detention Centre and other issues, that's when the public starts to realise that this has now become profoundly dangerous. And because we don't have the tools to respond, it's become extremely difficult.
This can I just add, this is the danger with not having the charter, right? The danger is that Australians actually think they have the right to freedom of speech and they don't. There is no actual right to freedom. There's an implied right to freedom of political communication. And that's one of the things that worries me. I do believe in freedom, particularly of speech and particularly political communication, is absolutely fundamental to a healthy democracy. And it did concern me because if we see these rights being abrogated at that level, then they're happening at levels where the average Australian is not even affected by them. And there are two things really that I questioned when that happened, was firstly the concern now that journalists are facing the potential of prosecution, and that's extraordinary that there is the fear they could be imprisoned for their investigations and what they write. And the second thing that I also questioned was, someone has to grant these warrants, right? Like, someone in some court, some judge is making this decision. So where do we draw a line in Australia in terms of empowering the journalists and ourselves, essentially, to not have fear of that persecution? And it is extremely concerning. But as Gillian said, it's when this happens, when powerful institutions react to the abrogation of the rights that the rest of Australia turns up and says, oh, my God, this can't happen. However, you know, on Palm Island, the police were granted a warrant to raid Aboriginal children and families' homes. They were effectively holding guns to Aboriginal children. And there was, you know, the Maloney case about that, and there was a remedy in the end. But I do agree with Gillian on this point that it's completely fundamental to a healthy democracy, and it's extraordinarily concerning that the executive overreaching on this point.
And I think both of you made a really valid point that there's this difference between journalists who have a platform that they can speak from and those in our community who don't, who are deliberately silenced and whose voices you can't hear. And I think this is a fitting time in Refugee Week to reflect on, post the federal election, what's happening on Manus Island and Nauru. And when you look at the last 6 years of immigration policies and indefinite offshore detention, and you look at the fact that Australia doesn't have a Charter of Human Rights that sets out those basic principles and standards and our obligations under international law, when we think about what's happening right now on Manus Island and Nauru, would that be different if we had a Charter of Rights? How would that be different?
Well, I think it would be, And the first thing to say is that it takes some time. So it's not just necessarily by having the act, but it's also, I think, the building of the culture within the public service or the legislature or within courts as well about how those rights get interpreted and then how they get implemented. But it is difficult. I mean, that possibly would have had a go, but it is difficult to see how we would have the situation that we have now if we had have had a National Human Rights Act that had at its core the right of all people to be treated with respect, dignity, equality and freedom, but that also enumerated and articulated what those various rights mean. I think it would have given that we may have still seen some fairly abhorrent refugee policy and we may have seen various attempts to do the things that have been done, but I think it would have given, it would have made governments, it would have provided more obstacles for governments to make those decisions and make those laws. It also would have given advocates another vehicle with which to challenge those laws. And I think at a community level, the normative effect that having a Human Rights Act as a part of your nation's laws and framework would have perhaps evoked more outrage from different parts of the community. So for all of those reasons, I think it would have been a different situation.
And again, I wonder if I could just give a point of contrast, because while all of these matters were going up to try to ensure that the rights of refugees on Manus and Nauru are being protected, a case went before the Supreme Court of Papua New Guinea on the same grounds, effectively, arguing that the men on Manus were protected by the provision in the Manus Constitution, in the Papua New Guinea Constitution, that all persons are entitled to personal liberty. Now, on the basis of that provision in their new constitution, relatively new, 1975, on the basis of that, they had an entrenched civil right to be treated, and the right to personal liberty. And the court unanimously found that to maintain these men in the detention facilities was in breach of their own constitution. And that's why you might remember in October a couple of years ago, the Papua New Guinea government was required to release those men, and they moved, sadly, to other detention facilities elsewhere on the island. But the key point on what I'd like to make is that Papua New Guinea, with a modern constitutional provision to protect liberty, could not achieve the same rights under Australian law, because we didn't have even the most simple of provisions, which was in effect in the Magna Carta more than 800 years ago. No man may be detained arbitrarily without charge or trial by his peers. And that's the key point, and it's the one that I think that's been made. Who's issuing the warrants? What are the checks and balances? Each of us is entitled to our day in court. And these men on Manus in particular have been there 4, 5, 6 or more years in conditions that are described by the United Nations as in breach of the torture convention. But who would have imagined that Australia would do this? You would have to commit manslaughter in the domestic courts. I'm telling you, you're the criminal lawyer here. But you'd have to commit manslaughter to get a sentence of that kind. And you've had your day in court. These people are absolutely trapped in appalling conditions. But the question now is with the election, where do we go to from here? How do we now move this argument forward away from the sort of more abstract ideas that we have about a charter to explaining to Australians that we need compassion and a rule of law approach to protecting the interests of these people, among many, many others?
And I think that's something that, you know, we can hopefully have a bit of discussion about tonight. But I suppose, is the charter an issue that is just for the left or the progressive part of politics or the right, the conservative part of politics? Is it a centrist issue? Do you think it's traditionally been seen as, you know, a left-wing issue or a right-wing issue? And how can we make people understand that actually it's about setting out those basic values that we already agree on? It's an issue that matters, doesn't matter where you sit on the political spectrum.
I think that's the work that we have to do. So, you know, historically probably it has been seen either as a left, or if you look at the discussion that sometimes is had around free speech or freedom of religion, that tends to be a province of the more conservative side of politics, and sometimes both use it for their own particular prejudice as opposed to their own particular belief in what everyone should be entitled to. But I think we need to tell more stories about what needs to be protected and what is at stake to everyday Australians, and so that people see their own stories, their own families, their own children, their own loved ones within the context of what a charter promises. I think we need a more active citizenry around this. Many of the things that we probably take for granted and that are intuitive to our understanding about democracy, some of them are codified in other laws, but we don't have that overarching piece of legislation that says this is what Australia stands for, this is how Australia intends to protect its people, these are the obligations that we place on government and other people who have duties under the Act. And I think it's if we can get everyday Australians, for want of a better description, to sort of buy into that and to care about that, then I think that's the work that we have to do.
And I think I'll just ask a follow-up question. So you mentioned freedom of religion in there, and I think we've spoken about the fact that, you know, there can be sometimes a balancing considered between competing rights, and this is something that the Australian government has committed to talking about in the first sitting week. So how should we look at this situation where you have groups on one hand who are saying, you know, I want my right to freedom of thought, conscience, religion and belief protected, and you have other groups that say, yes, but we want our right to freedom from discrimination equally protected? How does a charter deal with those competing needs within society?
Well, the charter itself probably won't. In other words, the charter will say you have a right to manifestation of your religious and political views and expression, but you also have a right not to be discriminated on particular designated grounds, sexual orientation, religious belief, nationality and so on, race, obviously. The Charter won't do that job for you, and that's where we come back to the courts again. Ultimately, the courts of every society that has a Charter of Rights of some kind has to make these determinations. And it's not easy. It's going to reflect the cultural and environment of that particular society. But I think we have to have faith in our own courts to strike that balance. Of course we respect the spirituality of our Indigenous peoples, the religious views of our Muslim community, our Catholic community, The High Court's been extremely broad in its view of the protection of the right to religion, which, interestingly enough, is in our constitution, unlike the right to freedom of speech, which is not in our constitution. It's an implied right. So how this will resolve itself, I don't know. And if we've got some major cases coming up in the High Court, one that concerned a public servant in the Department of Immigration who spoke out in her private time and under an anonymous pseudonym, spoke out against the asylum seeker policies and refugee policies in Australia. The government finally caught up with her through presumably surveillance techniques and sacked her. That was upheld at the federal court level, but the Administrative Appeals Tribunal gave a compensation for being sacked in what they'd considered to be an unreasonable manner. And she's now before the High Court of Australia, which will actually have to decide this case. Although we have a conservative court, I think it would be a court that could properly make the judgments about what are the limits to expressing your religious views. And we know this in the rugby case, the Falau case. It's a difficult question, and it's not one that I think any one of us presumably would want to give an authoritative or concrete answer. But we have checks and balances of systems where we can achieve reasonable and proportionate ways of dealing with these problems. And I think we have to have faith in those institutions. But what's happened is we've actually cut them out of the process, and that's been so damaging.
But if I could just finish by saying,
you're quite, to go back to the right-left issue, do I look like a radical lefty?
Some say yes.
This is an absurd analysis. No. And I love to say that, and that's why I love to talk about the Magna Carta, because these fundamental rights are common to all basic legal systems.
Yeah.
And I'm not arguing for something new or radical. I'm arguing for something that's centuries and centuries old and consolidated by the common law. And so I see myself as a profound conservative in arguing for these rights. Sorry.
Absolutely. In addition to having faith in our public institutions, especially when people bring matters before the High Court, I should clarify myself that it really has only ever been with Aboriginal activism, especially in the history of Australian institutions, that when we bring matters before the High Court, such as Wick, Mabo, you know, the Timber Creek case recently, it has been the High Court that has stood with us in interpreting those rights. And I think given the way the system currently is set up, you know, we've got the executive, the legislature and the High Court, I only think a First Nations voice can make that more robust. More robust, more inclusive, and especially if we had the tools like a human rights charter, to continue the conversation at dinner tables, at coffee events, at weekend brunch, at school sport, could only be a good thing for Australians in continuing the conversation. And I think it's not a matter of left or right. Look, the one thing we have learned, particularly in Aboriginal affairs in this country, is that it really isn't a matter of left or right or if you're in between or not. You know, the recent election honed home to us that issue that it's about strategy, really. It's about political strategy. And rights are easy to identify because they're fundamental to each of us. But the strategy behind enforcing those, whether it's you're aligning with left, right or greens, is really a matter of how you get there in having that legislation or bill or voice enshrined. And I think at the end of the day, that's the fundamental thing with a First Nations voice. It's about touching that inherent dignity amongst each of us. This is unfinished business within the Australian democracy. And if Australians can rise to the level of asking that really moral, legal and political question, you know, addressing the exclusion of First Nations, can we get that double majority in a referendum? I truly believe Australians can do it. And we now are faced with a Liberal government, and that's fine. You know, in 1967, it was a coalition government that tabled that bill, and it was unanimously supported. So we know there's a cross-section of the community that believe in rights. It's just creating that people's movement to get us there, and that's where the struggle really is.
And I like what you said about making sure that everyone has a voice. And on that note, this evening, it is now your turn, putting power in the hands of the people, as it were. So if you have a question that you would like to ask our panel tonight, please pop your hand in the air. Someone will find you with a microphone. Please wait until a microphone reaches you, because this is being broadcast live, and so that everyone here can hear you.
Thank you. In the same way that Jill was talking about that nexus of 2001, Children Overboard, and then the 9/11, Teela or the rest of the panel, do you think that there's also a nexus between that WIC decision, the 10-point plan, and then the 2007 intervention, which still continues to this very day in the Northern Territory, and whether or not that is has also created the kind of culture that Jill was talking about in terms of creating this idea in the minds of the public that First Nations people are out to take your backyard, that kind of thing? I'm just wondering.
Yeah, I think in Australia, the politics of fear sells votes. That's the reality, as 3% that we have come to learn, but there have been pragmatic changes as well. You know, it hasn't been completely disenchanting for us, but every battle we have had to fight has been a hard-fought battle. And we know that as 3%, we can't do it alone. And that's one of the things that just motivates me to inform Australians, because I think one of the general dilemmas is Australians are just unsure about what human rights are generally. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we all have equal access to them. And it means as well that laws are meant to change. Like, we live in this system that evolves with culture and society, and that's okay. I just think it's just shifting people's minds to the point to not be so fearful of the change, that it's actually a really inclusive and inviting process, and that this will be to the benefit of all Australians, not just the 3%, because right now we are... It's a really testing time for us, because on the one hand, there's this amazing progress in Australia, but then on the other hand, we know statistics are getting worse for First Nations, and that's just the reality. So I think if we can all embed and commit to continuing the conversation about rights generally, but also when it comes to the point of a referendum that absolutely we are still aiming for with the Liberal government, that Australians are willing to fight for that, because we've never had anything handed to us in the political sphere, especially in Aboriginal affairs.
That was a great question, because it was one sentence and ended on a question mark and was directed towards one of the panellists. So that's a challenge for whoever's asking the next question. Where are you?
Can human rights be applied for the big picture problems, like holding a government to account on action for climate change?
It depends what rights are protected under the charter that you pass. So, you know, I was talking about the Victorian Charter, that predominantly has, well, almost exclusively has civil and political rights. Increasingly, countries are looking at how you protect environmental rights, but also the rights of people that might be affected by... whether housing is affected by climate change or economic security is affected by climate change. So, yes, even if it's not directly a right under your charter, there are various other ways in which you could invoke the effect that climate change and the decisions and policies of government have on Australian people. So it might be around job security, it might be around education, housing, all sorts of privacy, for example.
So what if it's the right to water, for example? Like I live in I grew up and I was born and raised in Western New South Wales, and we have a real dilemma with the Murray-Darling Basin at the moment, and we have a dilemma with, for example, where communities are granted native title rights that don't include water rights. But at the same time, every Australian deserves that right, you know.
So there is a right under the Economic, Social and Cultural Rights Covenant, which discusses the right to an adequate standard of living. Mm. And the right to water is a subset, as is the right to housing. And there's been jurisprudence coming out of South Africa most recently about how the right to water is interpreted by courts. Mm. And in this particular case, it affected a large settlement outside of Johannesburg, where there were thousands and thousands of residents that did not have access to daily water. It was also a community that was particularly affected by HIV. So there were people being cared for in sort of shanty settlements that had no access to water. So their water was cut off after a certain amount of usage. And that community took that to the High Court in South Africa, to the Constitutional Court, and their right to water was upheld, which changed not just government policy, but also changed the resources that were allocated around water resources to that particular community. So there is definitely, depending on the rights that you protect under a charter, a way to protect environmental degradation.
Yes, perhaps I could add that exactly. You can draft the charter to include the rights you believe in, and what might have been in a charter 20 years ago will be different today, where the emphasis might be more on economic, social and cultural rights. I was up in Mullumbimby and the Northern Rivers a few months ago and talking to them about a charter of rights. And 2 weeks ago, they sent me a draft of the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities for Australia. And Mullumbimby could very well be that grassroots movement. But they have included a right to a clean environment. The Philippines have a right, a constitutional right to a clean environment. And that stops tanneries polluting waters that affect the lives of urban dwellers. So these things are very possible. And it may, I'm glad you asked that question, because it may very well be that Australians would respond more readily to some of those environmental concerns, Indigenous cultural concerns, for example, rather more than maybe the right to freedom of association or right to protest and some of the other civil and political rights. So, but it's up for discussion. But I think the first step in this journey that we're going to be on, I think, for some years to come, is that we need to see the value of a legislated charter, and then we can start talking about the rights that need to be protected by it.
Next question.
Emily Wood from the Right to Food and Water Coalition. We would like to reinforce what you have said about the human right to water. I don't think our people have it, particularly in remote communities, and indeed there's some doubt about Melbourne's water supply from time to time. But I'd like to add to that, what would you say about the human right to food, which is rarely discussed? But more than 10% of our population are food insecure. That's just the tip of the iceberg when you think that 40% of our population are dependent on other people for their food, particularly in remote communities, but in the streets around here, people are food insecure. And in this place, which is awash with food, those of us with entitlements don't see it. What would you say to that, please?
Well, I think it goes back to Gillian's point that it depends, you know, you can make decisions, our community, our country can make decisions about the rights that are most important at a particular point in time and into the future. And I think food scarcity, whether it's metropolitan or regional or rural, is becoming a thing that we're becoming more and more aware of. One of the reasons why governments are often a bit nervous about including economic, social and cultural rights into a Human Rights Act is because they think that they are more likely to involve resource allocation decisions. And that's possibly true, but so they should. If you look at the housing situation in this country or this state, if you look at the levels of homelessness that we have here in Victoria, there's still a 20-year waiting list to get into public housing. I mean, a right to housing under our charter might not fix that overnight, but it would certainly make governments think about what policies and what resources they are allocating and developing to make sure that that basic right that people have to food and to shelter and to an adequate standard of living is upheld.
And I think we've got time for one last question. I can see right up the back of the room. Time for one more.
The idea of legislative charter consists the idea of judicial review, where the countries that you just mentioned, US, Canada, everyone has a very strong judicial review, which we don't find in Australia, or like the Australian courts does not have the complete right to strike down a legislation. How do you see the Charter of Human Rights can ingrain this idea of judicial review in Australia? Checks and balance.
Well, can I start to answer that very important question? Our constitution does, of course, guarantee a right of judicial review, the review by the courts of a decision by a minister which is questionable under the law. That exists under our constitution, and it's a power that's very, very important. The difficulty is, and going back to the kinds of things we were discussing earlier, the overreach of executive power, is that most or many of these breaches of fundamental rights, the freedom of press, the raids on the ABC offices and News Corp, etc., these are not raids or intrusions in our privacy and our freedoms that are contrary to the law. They are an exercise of discretion by the minister. And it's not easy to challenge the exercise of discretion by a minister because there's no mistake as to law. It's a mistake. It's not a mistake. It's an exercise of judgment. And that's much, much more difficult to challenge. If we were to have a legislated Charter of Rights, it would be possible to expand upon that idea of judicial review. But it certainly exists as a very important part of our legal system. It's just that it's stymied by Parliament that grants discretions to ministers that make them close to immune from that judicial review process.
And I think on that note, I'm going to have to wrap up tonight's conversation at the Wheeler Centre. We've spoken, it's been a broad-ranging discussion, I think it's fair to say, but we've spoken about how human rights at foundationally are about fairness and equality and dignity and respect and compassion, and how our lives are better when we all treat each other with those basic values that we can agree on. We spoke about trying to bridge this divide between, you know, the left and the right and find a way to make human rights about all of us, and how a charter can do that, how a charter of human rights is a tool to put power back into the hands of the people rather than in the hands of politicians in Canberra. And I think we've spoken about quite a few big issues and how we can deal with them. And something that we'll have to keep thinking about over the next few years is not just looking at the kind of immediate issues as they come up with the current government, but looking at how we can build that stronger democracy for all of us. And we've been talking about this idea of it's important to put out buckets when there's a hole in the roof and it rains, but sometimes you have to fix the roof. And that's what we're talking about here with the Charter of Human Rights. We do have a bit of homework for you to go away. Hopefully you have a fire in your belly and you're asking the question that we couldn't get to was, what can I do about this? How can I support a campaign for a Charter of Human Rights? Well, you go to www.charterofrights.org.au and please sign the petition, join the campaign for a Charter of Human Rights if you support us. You'll get some of our updates and you'll get some news about how you can stay involved. Because this is a Wheeler Centre event, I assume you all love to read. So your homework for this evening, if you haven't done so already, please read the Uluru Statement from the Heart. It is a beautiful statement to read, and it is a piece of history that I think everyone in this room should go home and know about. And finally, please stay engaged. Please keep coming to events and keep caring about politics, having those conversations about a Charter of Human Rights. We're never going to get there unless we all start to talk about this even more. Thank you so much to our panellists.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.